So Josh, you're in the English department. So the first thing that might be surprising to some people is that your book is not about books, but museums. Tell us how this project came about.
Sure. I mean, it is connected to the work that I do in English because basically all the research I do on some level focuses on narrative. This particular project is long in gestation in some ways in that my co-editor, Amy K. Levine, was my professor as a graduate student. She put out the first volume of this book in 2007. So in 2017, when she decided that she needed some additional help editing the book, she asked me to join her since we'd been collaborating in a number of ways over the years as colleagues after I had graduated from Northern.
Cool. So the subtitle of the book tells us about the construction of history. How is history constructed and not just, as we might think, displayed through museums? That's a striking concept. How do museums construct history?
It's a complicated question to answer in some ways. There is a simple, straightforward response, which is the items that are selected for display in museums and the narratives that are created to explain those particular items are the foremost in setting an example of how we can understand what it is that's being interpreted there. And so anytime that a museum selects a narrative, decides on a singular narrative especially, to explain something, they're necessarily leaving out information and perspectives. In a more complicated sense, though, funding, attitudinal changes over time, and vogue in terms of museum practice. If you want to think about things coming in and out of style, all of those things affect the ways that we present history and the ways that we interact with history. We moved from a model in the early days of a whole bunch of things being stored in a cabinet of curiosity for visitors basically to interpret themselves into a world where we are given direct sort of explanations for how things work with little room for interpretation, which, as I said before, necessarily leaves out other perspectives, other ideas, and sort of a richness of interpretation.
And along the lines of that richness of interpretation, in your preface, there's a really interesting sentence that you state that diverse populations are included or excluded from museum narratives. Can you describe this or give an example of how this happens?
Sure. There are a number of examples in the book that are interesting in terms of the ways that groups are excluded from narratives or almost excluded. So the chapter that I wrote about Carton Plantation in Franklin, Tennessee, early on in the tour, I was told by the guide that we weren't going to talk about slavery, that even though it was a feature of the creation and furtherance of this property, that it wasn't a central factor in understanding Carton. And so even though we know that there were 39 slaves living and working on the property against their will, we aren't given those narratives largely. We're excluded from there. Another example would be the New Deal community of Arthurdale, West Virginia, that's explored in one of the other chapters, where we learn that from the outset, those communities were intent upon excluding certain populations, so much so that they had to create their own communities. And so the author of that piece looks at the ways that, for instance, African Americans, poor people, immigrants were not included in those stories, and the ways that if you're going to run a museum today and interpret history for people, you have to address those absences and make clear why we're looking at a predominantly white, lower middle class audience.
So you mentioned the plantation in Carnton, mm-hmm. The Carnton Plantation in Franklin, Tennessee. I mean, so you describe your experience in really interesting detail, and you describe your anxiety and that you felt complicit in it, and also another interesting phrase that you wanted to reinvent yourself as a visitor with a purpose, while at the same time the problem of perhaps, you know, offending the docent or being overly challenging. So as we go to museums, how should we, to use your phrase, reinvent ourselves as visitors with a purpose? What should we be looking for?
I think that you have to realize that we live in a world today where information is not just available from the specific source, in this case, the place that you're visiting. In other words, Carton doesn't own the narrative of Carton. You can do any manner of research in terms of other publications, looking online, educating yourself in general about the institutions of chattel slavery and plantation life, and then you arrive in those spaces, educated and ready to interact with a docent. We're so often taught to believe that museums are passive spaces where they function mostly as classrooms. A docent delivers information to you, you passively take it in and leave a more educated person. The problem is that there are a lot of factors involved in this. Carnton is a private institution. Carnton is a money-making institution. So there are biases at work in terms of how information is decided on and delivered in a narrative. As a visitor, if you're hearing this, for instance, the statement that slavery is not terribly important at this site or it's not central to the site, as a visitor, you should be interacting and trying to interrupt that narrative and ask questions and steer things in a different way. I talk about my own frustration in that situation in that I didn't do that, primarily because as a researcher, I want to be able to get the fullness of what's going to happen without steering it and changing what's happening so that I can report on that. But at the same time, I think as a visitor, were I to return, I would speak up at the risk of causing discomfort for people because then suddenly the narrative isn't so nice and tidy and it isn't so easily digested.
So one of the things, and you're talking about this, you're talking about writing an essay from your own experience, and there's that old canard of writing teachers that you should never use first person in your research. And I think people who read this book are going to find, unlike what they might think of a lot of academic criticism, it's funny, it's personal. Mm-hmm. The people are drawing on not only personal experiences, but their own feelings about it. That's a rule that no using first person is a rule you find yourself almost breaking at every turn. I mean, And why is this? And is this, as your scholarship, it seems essential to what you do.
I think it is. I think it's a recognition that it's important to have a multiplicity of voices and perspectives on any issue to be able to come to some sort of consensus understanding, even if that consensus involves dispute and disagreements. And so it seems very disingenuous to me to write in third person or in some removed manner that suggests that I'm not the human being responsible for synthesizing the research of other people with my own experience and making sure that the narrative I'm delivering isn't mirroring those that you're encountering in some museums that suggests that it's authentic and singular. I want to say, I am the individual who is telling this story. Here are the ways that I've researched it and built a frame to understand and suggest changes in practice without trying to pretend that it's anything other than my voice and my thoughts.
So what are you working on now? And I know you have something coming up in Murray that we look forward to seeing. So what can you tell us about?
Yeah, I have a few things going on. I've got an art show, just a small art show coming up at the Murray Art Guild in the month of March that's called Toy Stories. It's also about narratives and looks at the ways that antique toys specifically put in juxtaposition can deliver meaning and reveal things about the culture that we live in. I just finished writing a manuscript called The Kleptomaniacs Collection, which is, again, a first-person collection of essays about my grandmother, who was a kleptomaniac, that engages memoir and cultural theory and studies of material culture into one document. And then the last thing is Amy Levine and I are also working on a second volume of the first book that I worked with her on in 2010 called Gender, Sexuality, and Museums. And the new volume of that is going to involve activism and alterity and figuring about unruliness in museums and those narratives.
So Josh, you had an experience where some of your scholarship actually helped change the way that a museum did things?
Yeah, so the first book chapter that I published in the world of museum studies was called House Museum or Walk-in Closet, and it was looking at the ways that historic house museums in this country represent, or as a matter of fact, don't represent the lives of the gay men who created these spaces, even though they are money-making enterprises now built on that creativity. And the Museum of the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia let me know, or contacted me several years ago for some more information based on reading that chapter and thinking about ways that they could present one of the owners of that space, who was really responsible for turning it into kind of a showcase collection of American antiques and decorative arts, trying to figure out how to create a narrative about his life that would allow for a more authentic representation that addressed his same-sex relationships and the way that he lived his life, which is the first museum in this country to do that. And so we worked together and interacted about the ways that what I suggest in that chapter might change practice. And it did. And as a result, now there are a handful of historic house museums. Alice Austin is one of them that are doing that across the country. And so change is happening in terms of representation.
Thank you, Josh. Josh's book is Defining Memory, Local Museums, and the Construction of History in America's Changing Communities. Josh, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Andy.